Our next speaker is Dr. Sharmila Disanaki, who's the Peter Cannizzaro Chair and Professor of the Department of Surgery at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in Lubbock, Texas. She's a trauma, burn, and critical care surgeon, and she's been the trauma medical director for two major tertiary referral center hospitals serving West Texas. She also serves on the Ethics Committee of the American College of Surgeons, the American Burn Association, and she's currently the chair of the Women's Subcommittee of the Society of Surgical Chairs. In addition to her extensive clinical and research interests, she works to promote work-life integration, diversity, wellness, and prevent burnout among surgeons and surgical trainees. Thank you, Sharmila.
Thank you very much. All right. I'm a little podium allergic, so let's see if we can get our... Can we have the lavalier mic on, please? Okay. All right, good afternoon, everyone. I'm very glad to be here. So I want to talk a little bit about practical steps to deal with stress. And we've heard a lot about what to do in the aftermath of a bad operative complication, and clearly that's something as surgeons we need to worry about. But I want you to take a pause and think for a few minutes of your average week and of the stress you deal with in an average week. And I'm talking about stress for the whole day. So if you have children, don't tell me they're not a source of stress. They are. What proportion, who has the majority of their stress happen to them when they're in the operating room? Who thinks that's the majority of where your stress is coming from right now? Yeah, that's what I thought. So it's interesting because by all rights, what we do every single day in the OR should be incredibly stressful, right? And there are studies, a study just came out a few months ago, and there have been about three or four in the recent few years, that have shown that we do get stressed in the OR. So our heart rates go up, our respiratory rates go up. There's definitely physiologic stress. And it's a lot worse in trainees than in fully qualified surgeons. And it gets better with each year that you're trained, which basically means that, yes, there's stress, but everyone in this room has already pretty much figured out how to adapt to the everyday stress of operating. What we do is incredible, and we've all learned how to cope with it for the most part. Now, there are times, though, that it can get worse than usual, right? So we all know that when you're doing a big operation and suddenly there's unexpected bleeding, okay, now then I'm stressed, and I get stressed now even after doing this a few years. And so how do we handle that extra stress? And it is to be prepared. Some people do this for every case. They'll run through it in their head. Anyone here use that technique in the shower in the morning? You're running through the case in your head every step. A few people, yeah. So I don't personally use that, but a lot of people do. Interestingly, I find for myself and for some others that actually increases stress. So if it works for you, great. But for some people, it actually increases it. But what I do recommend is that you develop a contingency plan. And that is, think about your worst case scenario, whether it's cutting the ureter on a colon operation or making something bleed terribly. For me, the adrenal vein and adrenalectomy is like just the stuff of nightmares. And so think about your worst case scenario and develop a plan. But here's the secret. You don't just develop the plan in your head. You develop it with your team. And this serves a huge number of purposes. Number one, it means that you are not bearing this burden of stress by yourself. There's no reason for that. Yes, we all know we're captains of the ship. We're not abdicating responsibility. But you have a team. Make them a part of this. And the key is you're going to get everyone together and say, okay, guys, here's what I think is the worst case scenario. I'd like us to plan for this. So if I tear the IVC, I would like you, scrub tech, to do this. If you're doing a count at that time, please stop. And this is the set of instruments that you need to have available. And then you turn to your circulating nurse and you say, you know, what do you think? Should we have a vascular stapler in the room just in case? Or how about these proline sutures? Let's have them, don't open them, but have them right here in case everything goes south. Resident, this is what I think you should do at that time. And you get that whole team involved. And here's the thing. They're not hearing you as a panicky, incompetent, unconfident surgeon. They're hearing you as a thoughtful surgeon who's making a plan. And you should probably say, I don't expect to use any of this, But if this happens, this is what I would like to do. And here's, in addition to making your team feel responsible, it means that when the crap hits the fan, you are not screaming at your script tech because they're busy in the count and they don't understand why you're upset and now they think you're difficult. And then if you start to get agitated because you haven't made a plan, what do you think your team feels if they haven't prepared? They think you don't know what you're doing, right? They think you're panicking. And so now they're going to panic because the surgeon's panicking, and that never ends well. The other thing that a lot of people don't realize is one of the hardest things for us with an operative complication is the aftermath, right? Because people talk. And then your scrub techs talk to all their buddy scrub techs, who then talk to the other surgeons around who may be your competitors, and it becomes a thing. But if you're calm and collected during the crisis, then it becomes a good thing. It becomes Dr. So-and-so. Boy, they handled that really well. Cool as a cucumber. They were great. Not Dr. So-and-so was losing it over this problem. So how we plan to handle these is, I think, a very important part. And afterwards, just like we just heard from my colleagues, you do need to decompress. You do need to talk to your peers. And our family and friends, however much they love us, are never going to be able to understand what that space is like. So please talk to your peer surgeons about this, those you can trust and who are not going to use this against you. If you don't have that kind of person in your own team at work, firstly, you should think about a different team. But if that's not feasible, you can make that kind of team, that support group, through societies. That's why you're here at the American College of Surgeons, to make those connections with people with no vested interest. You can call and say, got it, can I just tell you about my day? This was awful. And that you can vent and commiserate. It's important. Okay, so that was acute stressor number one. Acute stressor number two is, I think, probably more common for all of you, and it's the tyranny of time. So tell me if this sounds familiar. You have an OR start time at 7:30 a.m. That's what your OR, you're supposed to be able to lay knife to skin at 7:30. And 60% of the time, you're actually doing that at 8 o'clock. And it's never one thing. It's always anesthesiology did this, or the OR isn't ready, or this wasn't right, or the night ran late. How often do things just not go right? Who has at least one disruption to their schedule from slow turnover or a slow OR start at least once a week? Okay, lots more of us, right? Yeah. So this is a huge problem for us. So it may not seem like a big stress, but this is the kind of thing that builds drip by drip, day by day, and it wears us out. I have no doubt that this causes frustration and burnout. It just gets you sort of drip by drip. So this is one way to react and deal with it, is that you just get mad. But getting mad every day is exhausting and wears you out drip by drip as well. And it doesn't really achieve anything, because after a while, if you get mad every time your OR runs late, people will stop listening to you when you're getting mad about something legitimate, because they're so used to you blowing your stack over every little thing. And so it's a natural response, but probably not the best one. I think there's different ways to handle this. So one way is you can meet with the OR directorship and leadership and try to figure out what's going on. And I think that's worth a try. If there's a chronic problem, you can get together with other surgeons, you know, and try to get to a point where you can figure out the solutions. And this is the only way we're going to have solutions, is if surgeons are at the table. Unfortunately, some meetings run a little bit like this, and sometimes that isn't very worthwhile. I think it's still worth trying. So then maybe the solution is that if you know that your OR is always going to be predictably about 30 minutes late, just go get a coffee. Start your day with a nice cappuccino, and don't worry about it. Because here's the thing. There are so many frustrations in life, and if you try to fight every battle, you will go insane. So you have to pick your battles. And some things are just not worth it, because it's like you trying to move a mountain. There's so much inertia in the system that sometimes it just can't be done. And then maybe you save that energy that you're pushing against this mountain, and you go use that energy to actually fix something that you can fix. You don't have to show up to every argument you're invited to. For those of you who are on social media, please remember that. You don't have to fight with everyone on Facebook or Twitter. It really doesn't pay. You don't have to show up to these arguments. We can let a lot of this go and then really focus on what matters. And so the final stressor, I did say I was going to do three stressors. So the final stressor is probably the most common because it's to do with human beings and it's interpersonal conflict. So who here has at least one interpersonal conflict with someone? It may be minor, but some conflict once a month. Okay, how about who has a recognizable conflict with someone at work once a week? Okay, so a lot of you are doing some amazing things. I don't know how you're managing to go a whole week without a conflict, but that's great. Because conflict is the water we live in. It's what we do. The reason I bring this up is that there are a lot of surgeons who will tell you that they left their practices because of conflict with their partners or their hospitals. And sadly, there are people who actually leave surgery and sometimes leave medicine altogether because of interpersonal conflict. And I think that's really a mistake because the truth is there is no field in this world that involves acting with human beings that doesn't have conflict. This morning, when I was in my room, I heard the housekeepers outside my hotel door having this full-blown conflict with each other. So there is no job that doesn't have conflict. The question is, how do we handle it? So again, we need to be prepared. It's the same principle that we talked about a few moments ago with the OR. But how do you prepare for a conflict? Well, if you know that you're going to meet someone who is maybe historically a bit of a problem for you, whether that is the scrub tech, the OR charge nurse, the CEO, the CMO of the hospital, whoever it is, your own partner, the first thing I like to say is have an escape plan. So this photograph is from, I'm sure you'll recognize it, the rescue of the Thai soccer team from the caves not so long ago. And we saw how it took a really good plan, 2 weeks of very careful execution, to get those kids out safely. They couldn't just ram in there with a submarine, right? So you need to have a plan. So you've got to think through before your conflict situation how you're going to escape if that becomes tense. And so here's a sentence that I like to use. And you're welcome to use this to either take it wholesale or modify it to yourself. So here's how it works. You always start by acknowledging, I appreciate you telling me this. Now, appreciate's a broad word. Maybe you can't stomach saying appreciate. Maybe I understand your concern. Craft a word that works for you, but you must have an acknowledgement because while in the moment, the heated moment, you're not going to appreciate this, there's always some tiny bit of useful information in every criticism, maybe microscopic, but it's there. And so some sort of acknowledgement is a good idea. The next part is it's non-defensive, right? You're not pushing it back. You're not aggravating the situation. But you're also saying, I would like a little time to process before I respond. Right? You're not saying, I can't cope with this. Go away. I can't deal with this right now. You're just saying, you know, I would like a little bit of time to process. What does that tell the other person? That you're thoughtful. You're mature. You're in control. But, you know, you're going to think about this a little bit. And then the next part is it makes it clear the conversation's over. You don't want that person to just keep harassing you. You've put a stop to this point, and you'll deal with it later. And the final thing it does is it sets a definite timeline for the next conversation. I'll text you in a few days. We'll meet. You're making it clear. I'm not just going to run away from you for the rest of my life, because that doesn't work. You will talk about this, but it's going to be on your terms, at your own pace, once you've been able to recover and put your thoughts together so that you can kind of control this a little bit better. So Amy Cuddy was very well-known, spoke on TED, and wrote a book on power posing. And there's been some stuff that's actually said that doesn't work, and regardless, there's some truth to what she said. So these are what's classically called low-power poses. You're making yourself small. A few of you in the room, I notice, are doing this. It's kind of habitual. You slouch a little. You make your space small. Self-touching, interestingly, women do that part much more than men. You know, if you're touching your neck, your hair, your arms, self-touching, all of those are low-power poses. And interestingly, the great apes do almost the identical low-power poses to what humans do. And these are the high-power poses. It's where you've spread yourself out, you take up more space. It's the classic Wonder Woman pose. Please don't do these in the midst of the conversation. That's not what I'm getting at. You do these in the restroom before the difficult situation, okay? This is the preemptive stuff. So go to the restroom, spread out, give yourself some high-power poses, about 30 seconds of it. Surprisingly, it actually makes a difference. It really does seem to reduce your cortisol. And there's been some studies, like I said, they're being disputed, but there's some studies that show it will increase your, lower your stress hormones and increase the sort of, reduce your physiologic response. I do think it helps. So I encourage you to try power posing. You can find a lot of details online. You want to learn how to breathe. Breathing's a great strategy in the midst of the moment. I've told you how to prepare. But during the tension, just breathe. Breathe from your abdomen. That really helps. Feel it down here, not up in your chest. That tends to get a bit emotional. And that's really good also in the operating room if it's a stressful point. The other thing you can do is recognize the emotion. For most of us, it's some variant of anger. But there's a difference between frustration and exasperation and full-on rage. And the better we get at actually labeling these emotions, the more we're able to choose to not act on it. But to do that, to get to the point where in the midst of a conversation, you can actually choose to step away and disengage, requires some practice. And it really does require some mindfulness practice outside of the conflict as a basic, some sort of meditation, mindfulness, thoughtfulness, contemplative practice, and that's a talk for another time, but there's plenty of resources, and if you're interested, I strongly recommend you look at this as being a part of your life, because it'll give you the muscles to be able to do this in the heat of a conflict. So this is my final, and I think all of you know what I'm about to say. Don't send the angry email, please. It is so tempting to just fire off the email. And so what do? We get mad. We get ourselves into a self-righteous lather because we're so right and the other person is so wrong. And then we want to email them and then we have to copy their boss and 15 other people who this person's going to be so totally destroyed and embarrassed. And then we just want to hit send in our self-righteous fit of fury. Don't do it. It never ends well. Okay, so here are two rules I'm going to give you to not ever do this again because it will really cause you about 15 times more trouble than you started with. So I impose a mandatory 24-hour delay before I send that email. Mandatory. Don't let your angry self talk you out of this. And then when you do the 24-hour delay, what you do, so I type these scathing things. I'm sarcastic by nature, so I get some really good stuff out there, but I don't fill in the address line. So where it says to is blank. So I can't even accidentally send it because you really don't want that to happen. So I make sure I don't fill in an address. I type this scathing thing when I'm in the moment, and then I save it, and then I'll come back the next day. And not once have I ever sent that version of the email. About 75% of the time, I'll just delete it. Actually, probably about 50%. The other half of the time, I rewrite it, and it's a lot better when it goes out. It's now thoughtful and considered, and it still makes the point, but without making myself look bad. So, and I'll usually drop all the people on the CC column and just send it to that person and maybe one other. So there's really ways to do this that are better. Don't ever send the angry email. So thank you all. I hope some of these have been practical for you, and I look forward to your questions.